The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
So tonight, a little bit of what I'm going to do is talk about motivation and why kids might do things. Not necessarily the nuts and bolts of, okay, so what do I do, which sort of flows naturally from the why do they do it. But a lot of what I want to focus on tonight is trying to understand a little bit about the motivation of why kids might do what they do. And please definitely, like, stop me at any time or just jump in with any questions or comments or examples from your own life, we'll make it a friendly atmosphere. Good. Tough to see the clock. Okay.
Oh, it's right behind you.
Oh, perfect. Okay. So somebody will give me the 5 minutes. So I guess we'll go to, you know, maybe a 8:45, and people generally, like, have questions, and so I'm here for that. Okay. Great. So in doing a lot of these, you know, like, parent meetings and speaking with parents generally, you know, in a clinical setting and certainly in a school setting, one of the major things that comes up is, why are kids misbehaving? Now, I guess the first step is, let's define what it is misbehavior. So let's throw it out there. What's a kid misbehaving?
Tantrums, whining, crying.
Okay, good.
Screaming.
Certainly one form. Excellent. What else?
Defiance.
Okay. How would it come out?
Refusing to do what they've been asked to do,
right,
or to not do what they've been asked not to do.
Take out the garbage and they don't take it out.
Great.
Excellent. What else? Okay, sure.
On their siblings.
Sure. Excellent. What about less aggressive, less obvious forms of misbehavior? Okay. What about completing their homework in 7 minutes when it should be 20? Okay.
Yeah.
Right? So is that misbehavior?
No.
No? Why not? What is it then? It could be not. It's possible it's not.
What? It's the homework.
They really didn't do a good job.
They don't
want to
sit down.
That's right. So now we're talking about motivation, and you're 100% right. But let's look at the behavior. What do we want to label it? Do we want to label it as are they misbehaving?
They're just rushing through. Yes.
Yes.
Get to the next activity.
Okay.
They don't want to.
And the kid that's not
money.
And the kid that's not taking out the garbage because they want to ride their bike.
Do something else.
Are they misbehaving? Right. So I think we can be relatively liberal when it comes to definition of misbehavior. I think some things obviously are very overt, right? Smashing your younger sibling over the head with a hammer, that's misbehaving. Right? Refusing to do something that was asked of you directly is certainly misbehaving. But there's some more passive forms of how kids can show what's, you know, rebellion, or, you know, sort of showing their own personality, we could even call it. Good. So now we have, like, some operational definition, and all of these things are correct, certainly, about misbehavior. So then it comes to a question of, okay, so why are they doing this? What is the motivation behind what's going on?
They want your attention.
Good.
So, they don't know how to ask for it.
Good. So the point you're bringing up is, I think, a point of communication, right? Not feeling that their needs are getting met in an adequate way. Very good. And that's certainly something we're going to talk about very, very soon. The number one reason, I think, that parents talk about in terms of kids' misbehavior is misbehavior is a form of kids being able to learn what's appropriate and what's not. Right, so if a kid says, well, I don't want to do my homework, or I don't want to take out the garbage, or I want to smack my little kid over the head, this is a wonderful opportunity for us to be able to teach them appropriate norms of conduct in school, at home. Certainly, we socialize them, right? Our responses to boys and girls are very different based on their behavior and based on our own perceptions of what they should and shouldn't be doing. you know, how many 14-year-old boys are asked to make a potato kugel, right? And what would they say to refuse it? But if a 14-year-old girl, right, refused to participate in that process, we'd be kind of upset. So part of the misbehavior also has to be taken in the context of what are the social rules that we're sort of trying to teach the kids. So in that way, we can look at misbehavior or any behavior where we've asked the kid to do something and they haven't done it in a great way as really a form of them learning, what is my role here in this house? What is my role in school? What's my role in society? In terms of boundaries also, boundaries we refer to obviously physical boundaries, going into a bathroom and somebody else is there, right? That's a boundary that children need to learn. And if they're misbehaving, typically they're trying to understand, what is this boundary? Why are people getting so upset about it? How much can I push? How much can I not push? Certainly issues with SNEAS amongst siblings is a very important issue. And kids are desperately trying to learn how it is they sort of negotiate all the things that they're supposed to pick up on. And we sort of assume that kids are supposed to just know these things. But really, through their behavior, they're trying to learn it. And I think that's an important point for parents to recognize about sort of this misbehavior or any behavior that isn't doing what it is that you really want them to do, is perhaps asking the question, well, is it fair for me to assume that they should know this? And if it is fair, so then maybe I need to look at that. And if you sort of ask yourself, take a step back and say, I'm not sure. Maybe I do need to teach that in a different or in a better way. Perhaps it's not misbehavior after all. Perhaps it's learning. So that's really the first major category of perhaps why kids aren't doing what it is that we ask them to do, because they're really desperately trying to learn what is appropriate and what's not appropriate. what is it that they're supposed to sort of have ingrained in their head, and what is it that they're really trying to pick up on? We see from the next cartoon, if everyone has, do you have a copy of it? Okay. We see from the next cartoon, and this is sort of the bridge between the first reason and the second reason, right? What's the name of it? Is this Lionel? No, this is... Oh, thank you. See, it's good here. So she's it, right? Can I not take this test, right? Because she's trying to reduce stress in her life. So this is an issue. I think it's a cute cartoon. This is an issue of trying to learn appropriate boundaries. How much can I push? How much can I be honest? How much can I communicate? And how much are people really going to care? Like, yes, we're very sorry that you have all the stress in your life, but you still need to take this test, right? We often respond to our children in that way, like, I'm very sorry that you don't want to do this, but you really still need to do it. So being able to approach them in that way. But really the bridge that I see is the second reason, typically main reason why kids misbehave, and that is misbehavior is a form of expressing some sort of need, like you talked about before, that there's some either psychological or physical need that for whatever reason is not being met, or that's being sort of undermined in a home environment or in a school environment, that this kid is trying to communicate. So the best example, and you know, and these are case examples which happen to all of us, but I sort of you know, everyone has kids, but you know, when you're a therapist, like, you sort of see everyone else's kids also, and you know, yeah, I remember that. And you know, and sort of have exposure to sort of like a wide range of all this behavior. But I think the number one theme that and the conflict that exists between parents and kids, especially when kids get older, is typically kids not feeling like the parents understand what it is that they're going through. And it could be something major, and it could be something relatively minor. You know, recently I had a 17-year-old kid who wanted to go ahead and get married to another 17-year-old girl, and they thought it was perfectly appropriate, and they didn't think why their parents, you know, thought it was an issue. We love each other. okay, let's talk about this. But a lot of what they were running away from, and a lot of what it is that was going on sort of behind the scenes, is them not appreciating, or is this boy not feeling like the parents really appreciated what it is that they were going through in terms of his loneliness, in terms of his dissatisfaction with his own home environment, in terms of never feeling like he really fit in any academic environment, and this girl made him emotionally feel very good about himself. So sort of through that understanding, right, he through this misbehavior, right, I think everyone would say, thank you, I think everyone would sort of agree that wanting to elope is misbehavior. Right, in its broadest sense. But what sort of need is a child trying to communicate through all that stuff? Another really important point, I think, is that typically kids really do lack the communication skills, by and large. There's some kids that are really verbally very advanced and very in tune with what it is that they're feeling. But by and large, kids, even up until early adolescence, are not completely in touch with what it is that's going on with them. And so there's this very large tendency to act out behavior instead of talk out behavior. And through their actions, we get to see sort of what it is that they're feeling and experiencing. I think the number one best example that I can think of is bullying, which certainly has been spotlighted in a lot of schools, and I think there's a lot more happening, and there are a bunch of reasons for it. But if you have a kid that's consistently coming home and beating up a younger sibling, I would want to look at the motivation of that behavior. Hey, Yanko, what's going on at school? You know, is somebody acting towards you in this way? So this child is trying to express to us a very significant pain that's going on in their life, but they can't express it because they feel embarrassed, they feel wimpy, they feel like you're going to judge them, you feel like you're going to get on the phone that minute, and which parent wouldn't, to call the principal and to call this guy's mother and to, you know, for the father to go down and stand in front of the bus at the bus stop and beat up this guy, if you ever touch my boy again, right? So the kid knows this, and the kid knows what your reaction, right, your very visceral, perhaps appropriate reaction is going to be, and they don't want to start that chain of events, so they keep it inside. But it needs to go somewhere. It can't just stay inside. It needs to go somewhere. So they act out, and they're trying to communicate it, because obviously their ultimate wish is to communicate pain, but they might not have the words for it. So you see it allowed in behavior. Another way where we see it, and you know, again, I told you sort of my clinical focus is we see very often with issues of sexual abuse, or when kids are sexualized in a very early way. I left for everyone sort of web guidelines. You know, people can take it home as appropriate, but certainly there's a lot of information available on the internet and through conversation and whatever it is. And we're talking about younger kids that are really starting to engage in conversation. Again, it's not their fault. They're not doing it in any malicious way, but they're gaining all this information about things that their bodies and their minds are just completely not ready for, and you see it acting out in a lot of very significant ways. And certainly if you see kids that are acting out in a sexually aggressive way towards other kids, you sort of want to ask yourself, well, where is this coming from? Because it's certainly not natural. A lot of the psychological pain that we see kids trying to express through their misbehavior has a lot to do with trying to understand their own issues of self-esteem. Who am I? Who am I not? What am I good at? What am I bad at? And a lot of internal frustration. What is it that again, you know, back to these existential questions of what's my place and where am I and who am I? And really trying to understand that through issues of self-esteem. And probably the way we see this the most is when kids will say to us, you know, I never felt like parents loved me enough. Well, we know as parents that we put a lot of time and effort and certainly love into all of our children, by and large, right? There are obviously exceptions. So how is it that kids don't perceive this love, and how is it that they don't experience it? Well, a lot of it has to do with their own cognitive distortions, their own thinking about what it is that love means, and how come he gave this to this person and that to that person, and sort of, you know, all those things need to come out, and we need to talk about it, and we need to be realistic about it. But a lot of times when it comes specifically to the behavior, and this is something that you really brought up before, a lot of misbehavior is kids knowing that if I do the right thing, maybe I'll get a thank you. But if I do the wrong thing, I'm going to get a 5-minute speech. So 5 minutes versus 3 seconds. Which kid wouldn't choose the 5 minutes, even if it comes with some sort of pain? Because ultimately, what are kids looking for from parents? And how does attention come about? How do they measure it? How do they measure it?
Even if it's negative, like being in your room.
It's crazy, right? It's crazy.
I'm just, my own perspective. Is there so much thought? Like a 7-year-old wants to just talk to his parents.
There's a lot of unconscious thought, I think.
As opposed to time out, like.
Yeah. Because what are kids looking for? How do they measure this love and the attention? How do they measure it? But you guys are saying the same way. It's time. That's the kids. You know, measuring
time out.
What happens in time out though? What happened? No, that's not true.
They're on your mind.
So what's happening, right?
They're noticed.
You didn't do fill in the blank. You didn't clean up the toys, and you know that if you don't clean up the toys, you have to go in timeout, right? So now, let's say for a smaller kid, you take the kid by the hand, right? You bring them into timeout. Think about what you've done, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to fetch you, right? And then we're going to talk about it some more, right? That's the way timeout generally works.
I set a timer, and I don't talk to them. When the timer goes, so I'm not paying attention to them.
Good. So what's the difference then? So hang on to that for 1 second. Hang on to it, because it's a good example also, right? So do we see, right, that there's a lot of time and attention spent in this whole timeout process?
Yeah, and we're not paying attention to the other kids who weren't.
That's right. That's exactly right. Right? So there's a lot of time. Good. So even if you do the timer thing, right? What's the difference? Think about this. What's the difference between a timer and a young kid bringing a teddy bear or a blankie to school with them, or a favorite toy? These are what's called transitional objects, that the kid associates this object with you, right? So teddy bear provides comfort. They know that you give them a kiss at night. The teddy bear is there, so they associate all that love with this teddy bear. They go to school. They don't feel so good about themselves. They look at the teddy bear, and they put a big smile on their face because they remember all the love and warmth, right? Conceptually, there's no difference between a teddy bear and a timer, except that the teddy bear generally doesn't make that really annoying noise at the end, right? But conceptually, there's no difference. So are you physically spending time? No, but you're psychologically, you're there with them in the room. So timeout makes a heck of a lot of sense for kids because they're getting a lot out of it.
Because they impacted you.
Exactly. I know I got their goat, and they're seething, right? They're, right? Parents have 100 things to do, so now I got them, now they're on my mind. Now, is this conscious at all? Typically not. With some kids who are very savvy, it starts to be. But typically, these are very unconscious things that kids are learning, and they pick up on it. They know, okay, great, I've gotten more time. Now, would it be nice if I could get this time in a good way? Absolutely. But, okay, I'm not, because I got X number of other kids to deal with, and dinner, and baths, and laundry, and, right, our own jobs. So good. So, kids want this time, and kids certainly are beginning to understand, even through adolescence, they're beginning to understand that often the only way to express pain is to act it out instead of talk it out, right? So obviously in terms of suggestion, okay, so what do we do, which we'll get to in a little bit, this goes back to maybe the second or third speech that was done here in terms of communication skills, of being able to forge those bonds with kids and being able to help them to develop the skills to be able to communicate in a good and healthy way. So see that class. Go ahead.
Yeah. It's funny because when I had my baby, I think my 4-year-old and 5-year-old told me, like, you're not my mother.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, you're not my parents. And I'm like, what? I'm like, I gave birth to you. And
right.
She said her parents were in Israel. And that was her way of communicating. I'm like, Mom, I need your attention. And my other son was looking at like, who are your parents? You know, I'm like, what?
Yes.
So I'm just, it took me a while.
And it lasted
at first I was
10 days,
like,
right?
Hard.
10 days,
no,
3 weeks.
Sorry,
how long did it last, brother?
Like a week.
Okay, so that's.
Because I didn't understand what she was saying.
Right, so
I felt very.
And that's certainly on the short end, right? And she made you feel that way, and now you're feeling.
And then it made sense.
For sure.
Maybe I need to spend more attention with
that. Right. And in very sick children who don't have a mother that's going to care about them in. For every minute, right,
right.
Until that point, they develop a lot. They develop and encourage all of these dissociative thoughts,
mm-hmm.
and really start believing that this person over here does not care about me, but there is somebody over there that does care about me. In sick kids, but you have a healthy kid.
I was gonna say at that age, you're lucky that she has some form of communicating with you, not to know that, but. Just like you're saying.
Yeah, that was her way.
I need you.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't understand. It took me a while to figure it out what she wanted.
So the best analogy that that I could think of in terms of, you know, when parents come and say, like, I just had this kid and my whatever year old is
right.
acting out terribly.
Right.
So the best analogy that I ever give to parents is, imagine if your husband comes home and says, hon, I found someone really nice, but I still love you, but you know, she's really nice too. And, you know, maybe we could work it out that, you know, she'll come over also and, you know, she'll start living with us. But I have plenty of time and attention for both of you and we'll work this all out. And, you know, please don't feel jealous at all in any way. And, you know, I have plenty of love, you know. You have to understand, you know, love is not a pie, you know, we don't split it up in even pieces. Love is infinite and we could always have love, and you know, I have plenty of love for both of you, right? Imagine a wife's reaction to that statement of her husband. What?
Right?
So typically that's the way kids are going to perceive this issue of parents are cheating on them. And that's something important for us to tune in. Now that doesn't mean that we have one kid necessarily and say, well, you know, how am I going to affect this kid? It's an important lesson in terms of being able to split up love. Yes.
In a way where what's going to happen? How do you tell the child so he's more or she's more accepting of it?
Yes.
In a way where.
So something we'll get to in a minute, but a lot of it is preparation. Here's what's going to happen. Perhaps going to doctor appointments, if appropriate, depending on the age of the kid. Getting a book about, you know, sort of what happens. A lot of it has to do with the preparation, and this is something we'll get to in a minute. So, remind me about that example, okay? I'll just go this way. The kids generally will find a way to have people to care about them if they feel that their parents aren't, right? Which is a lot of things that we see with traditionally with older adolescents, quote unquote, kids at risk. I don't know any kid nowadays that's not at risk, but right, the quote unquote kids at risk, they find a group of people that they really feel care about them in a tremendous way. It's conceptually no different than a gang, right? All the dynamics that happen in a gang, people feeling like this is a new family that can support and encourage all of those feelings of love and needs that they really want. So we see in Dennis the Menace, right? That Dennis is putting time out, right? And his chevra over there, right? This is my support group, right? So he's putting time out, meaning that he did something to warrant a certain punishment from this adult, from this authority figure. But who is it that's coming to save him from this emotional turmoil? These are his friends around him. So it immediately sets up this dialectic between my friends and you as parents. And that's something that can be very dangerous and certainly very difficult for kids. Good. Top reason number three why kids misbehave, and this goes to the birth question, that the changes have occurred too quickly or they've occurred in an unexpected way. Right? You see all the time if you go to you go to like the Chol Hamoed outings or something like that, right? Go to the zoo, go to the aquarium, go to an amusement park, right? That you always see the parents, right, dragging the crying kid away from the thing. Why does it happen? Well, obviously the kid's having a great time. But typically if you follow that family for 5 minutes before the tantrum, right? What happened was that the mom said, okay, we're going. Well, I'm not done. I'm not ready. I can't switch that quickly, right? My transmission doesn't go like that. You have to press the clutch, right? Kids are always on manual. You have to press the clutch. You haven't prepared them to make that transition, right? So that tantrum can certainly be avoided, right? If you say to the kid, we're going to spend another half hour here, another 10 minutes here. You can choose the last thing that we do. But there's going, right, the statement of transition, especially with younger kids, is extraordinarily crucial. And that's typically why most of the misbehavior occurs, is that the change has occurred much too quickly. It's unexpected for this child, and they're acting out these feelings of, well, what's going on to my world? What's going on in my world here? And they're desperately acting that out in an effort to try to get you to understand, not to stay, because they know that if they lie on the floor kicking and screaming, they're not staying. Right? Typically, a parent's not going to say, okay, fine, let's go on the roller coaster. And if they do, they've lost this kid for a long while. So typically, a parent is not going to do that. So what is this? What's the kid trying to gain? And what he's trying to gain is again your attention and your focus on the fact that this is really difficult for me. And if you're able to do that, I think a lot of these tantrums, especially in the younger kids, but also in the older kids, a lot of the more, let's call it, passive aggressive kind of behavior, can certainly be minimized even with adolescent kids if the changes are something that's expected to them. If we look at this little graph. If we look up stress in the dictionary, what do we come up with? Come on, all you vegetarians. What?
Friction.
Interesting. Okay. That's number two. Sorry. That's the number two definition. What's the number one definition of stress?
Stress.
This throws everyone.
Pressure.
What?
Pressure.
That's number two.
Change.
No. Number one. That's still number two. That's all right. It's all that same guy. The number one definition of stress is emphasis. Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Something that we put emphasis on. So typically the behavior that we see or something that potentially can cause us what we call stress, right, feeling it over here, typically has to do with what we're putting emphasis on, right? None of us have this, extraordinary stress about, like, who's going to win the next election in China, right? Like, I really don't care very much. But we have a lot of stress about where we're going to send our kids or who they're hanging out with, right? Because we choose to emphasize those things. So kids do that all the time, right? If they're doing something nice or if they're doing an event that they appreciate, or they're engaged in an event that they don't particularly care about, they're by definition putting emphasis on something that's important to them. And so when we take that away from them, it creates, right, that second component of stress of the feeling over here. And the feeling over here only has to do with the way they're perceiving the event by what they're emphasizing. So what do we do with all that? So there are really two forms of stress. There's what's called distress, right, which we're all familiar with. But then there's also a form of stress which is called eustress, right, from EU, from the prefix for what? Feels good, like euphoria, right? So there's a certain element of stress that's positive, right? We all know in our own life that when we're overly productive, right, things get extraordinarily hectic and we feel extraordinarily stressful, right? We feel stressed out. When we're sitting in bed twiddling our thumbs doing nothing, right, we're also stressed out because typically people want to move and do. Right? Sometimes it's nice to take a break, and that's very necessary. But if it happens too much, right, we feel frustrated with ourselves. How come I'm not doing and producing? So there's a very fine line between the stress level and the productivity level. So if we find a nice balance between productivity, we can be in a nice area, and that nice area of eustress. Typically for kids, their productivity level, right, is not defined in terms of widgets produced or number of clients seen or whatever it is, but their productivity level is how much am I accepted, how much am I understood, how much do I feel I'm fitting in, right? That's the kid's measure of their own productivity. So if they feel that they're not being accepted, they're not being loved, they're not being appreciated by peers, by parents, sort of all of those things, they're going to be in this area of distress. On the other side of the coin, right, the very popular, very with it kind of kid that has to continually sort of keep that up also experiences a tremendous amount of stress, but that stress often gets overlooked because they're coping so well, and you know, they have so many friends and they're doing wonderfully in school, and right, so it's easy for a parent to say, okay, that one, I don't need to worry about that one, right? She's doing fine, right? She's got friends, she's doing well in school, right? Everything's great. But internally, potentially, that kid is experiencing a tremendous amount of stress because they need to keep that up. These are the expectations that people have set up for them and they've set up for themselves. You know, which certainly goes to this issue of transitions and changes, because they feel that they can't change those gears. They can't go from Miss Popular to Miss No Friends, because that would create, obviously, a tremendous amount of stress in their life. So we need to help them try to navigate sort of that change. This is just a cartoon I threw in there because I liked it when the zebra feels overly stressful, right? Its own definition is unknown, right? It loses its stripes, literally, that we don't know what this thing is anymore, right? Zebra, horse, what am I? Right, when I'm stressed out, typically that's generally that's when people feel most frustrated with themselves, and when people feel most frustrated with them, right, is under these overtly stressful times where this person like sort of turns into a monster, or you know, very demanding, or you know, whatever it is that's going on. Now this is certainly how are we doing on time? Wow. Okay. Need to speak quickly now. I think another reason why kids misbehave, and this is a very difficult and delicate part of the presentation to bring up, so I'll be delicate, is a lot of times kids learn from us what it is to misbehave. The most recent example that I can think of happened... Well, the story happened a year ago, almost a year ago, because it was camp time, but it recently came to me. a kid who now has a terrible gambling problem. He's 15 years old, and he's $27,000 in debt, and he has one leg broken because people wanted to collect money, and he got his parents' credit card. It's just a whole mess. But how did all this behavior get started? So he was in camp last summer with poker chips, you know. So after lights out, the kids had a poker game, and they started playing poker. A couple of the kids got wild. They were jumping on the bed. One of the kids, you know, fell off. and hit his head. So they ran to get the, kids were playing poker. Head counselor walks in, sees the kid playing poker, confiscates the chips. Okay, so now the poker chips are confiscated. Next night, kids don't have anything to do because they used to play poker, so now they're wild. Kid jumping on the bed, kid jumps off, hits his head, bleeding. They run to get the division head and the head counselor, and the division head, the head counselor, the assistant head counselor, and the director of the camp are all sitting around the table playing poker with this kid's poker chips. So, a lot of this misbehavior is sort of picked up on kids in very subtle, but sometimes not so subtle ways. And I think we need to be very cognizant of what is it that we're teaching kids in terms of respect for other people, right? How do we expect parents to respect us if they hear us yelling to our own parents on the phone? How is it that we expect parents to have respect for us if our elderly grandmother never comes for Shabbos? You know, sort of thing. And this is why it's tough, because this touches everyone over here. Like, I have to call my grandma, right? But right, which goes through everyone's mind. But you know, the fact is that they pick up on this stuff, right? They pick up on these attitudes. And that's very difficult as parents to really come to terms with, right? It's like, oh gosh, do I really teach them that much? And the answer is yes. Because if you expect to be able to teach them the things that you're actually verbally teaching them, right, which generally goes from here to here in like 4 seconds, they pick up more on the stuff that you don't say, but it's actually what you're actually doing, right? So when you come home and talk about that guy in shul, right, or that woman in shul, right? Well, and then the next day, right, you get a note home from the kid's teacher that they were disrespectful to someone in the class and they were calling him names. Well, where'd that come from? Right, it might not be expressing a psychological pain of this kid, but they're mimicking our own parental behavior, and that's something that's very painful, but something that's certainly very real. Communication, I'm just skipping around for time's sake. Communication issues are also learned from kids, meaning that we talked about how generally how kids will act out instead of speak out their issues. If that happens amongst spouses, right, it's going to happen with kids, right, that if somebody gets angry and starts yelling before they talk out an issue, generally, your kid is not going to step back and say, okay, mom, dad, can we talk about this? Right? They're going to get angry. They're going to get frustrated almost immediately. Is that necessarily genetic? Well, maybe. There is a genetic component to anger. But couldn't a lot of it just be a lot of learned behavior, that this is the way they're seeing relationships taking place in their own home? And this puts a tremendous burden on us as parents, I think. Good. So sort of, I think, two more things, and then we'll get to the, okay, so what do I do? Why do kids misbehave? Another reason is I think we perhaps, with some kids, set the bar too high. Our expectations are up here, and their ability is over here. And this space creates a lot of frustration, not only for us, but also for our kids. So the immediate suggestion is, are my expectations realistic? Are they appropriate? Are they age appropriate? Are they gender appropriate? Because kids do have gender roles that we're teaching them. And most importantly, is my request or the thing that we're talking about, is this in line with something that goes along the general makeup of my child, meaning, right, if a child is very introverted and very nervous, very anxious, let's say even when they're older, 15, 16 year old kid, and they don't appreciate social situations at all, and they get very nervous, they get very worried. This happens a lot in shidduchim issues also, right? You get a 19, 20-year-old girl, you know, go to the l'chaim, go to the kiddush. Well, I feel very miserable going. I don't like being on show. I don't like doing this. No, go, go, go. It's going to be good for you. It's going to be good for you. Right? So finding the balance between, yes, we want to motivate this girl, let's say, to get out there. But at the same time, my expectation is that you're going to do this, but that's not in line with your general makeup. Generally, you don't like these social situations. So maybe me as a parent, I need to find a different way for you to get out there, where for people to know you. but a lot of our expectations, failed expectations that we had of ourselves as kids, and desperately try to make our kids fix all those mistakes. And is that a fair thing? And sometimes it is, because sometimes the kids have that ability to do it. But sometimes it's just us trying to relive what it is that we felt that we could have done better and actually didn't. Okay, so let's talk about maybe one more thing. And this is also very difficult. Why do kids misbehave? Well, they don't have appropriate limits. They don't have appropriate expectations that are set out before the situation. If a kid is learning a parent's expectation while in a situation, it's too late. You've lost the kid. boundaries, limits need to be known ahead of time. If a kid is going out and says, I'm going out to a movie, I'm going to learn. 16-year-old kid, and they say, well, and a parent says, well, remember to be home by 10:30. Well, this is the first time we're ever talking about curfew, right? What's going to happen, right? You're either going to have this terrible blowout before the kid actually leaves, right, and everyone winds up feeling extraordinarily miserable, or the kid's going to show up at 11 o'clock and say, oh, I forgot, or oh, I didn't realize, or whatever excuse, right, might be in line with the personality of this child. But you're going to have acting out. And it's simply because these expectations weren't known ahead of time. So we need to be able to set appropriate limits. And again, this is not being mean. This is doing our job. And our job as parents is to sort of set out these expectations in a clear and certainly in a very consistent way, as frequently and as often as is possible. So the typical counter argument that parents say is, well, they're going to rebel against my rules. I haven't been around for forever, but I have never had a situation where a kid rebelled against a rule when they were asked for input about the rule and the rule was talked about ahead of time. They will rebel if the rule happens, if it's an ad hoc rule. But if it's something that's set out, if it's something that's consistent, if it's something that they were actually asked for input, right? There's nothing wrong with asking a 16, 17-year-old kid who has relatively decent judgment, well, what do you think a fair curfew is? Well, Shimmy's dad lets him, well, no, I didn't ask you what Shimmy's dad. What do you think is a fair and appropriate curfew? And if the kid is going to come up with something generally, the kid is going to come up with something that's typically within your range. And they might even be more machmir than you ever thought. So if there is sort of this input, typically the kid is not going to rebel against these kind of rules. Good. So what do? I have some sort of, I have bronchitis or something, and it's still there. I apologize for the coughing, and also for the tape, I apologize. Maybe they could edit it out or something. Good, so what do? So I'm not going to talk a lot about punishment. I'm going to talk a little bit about punishment. But in terms of what do? Certainly, I think the number one thing that comes from the conversation is using misbehavior as an opportunity to teach a kid what's appropriate and what's not. It's a wonderful time to have a conversation, and if you're so stressed and so frustrated that you can't have that time to explain misbehavior to a kid, you probably shouldn't be punishing them either, because you're way too stressed and frustrated to do something appropriate. Right. So,
what would you do?
At that time, again, I think it depends on the age of the kid and sort of the situation and what's going on around them. But I'd be able to, you know, to say to a kid, well, you did this and this. I assume you know that here's our rule about that. So what's going on? What do you think was going on? And let the kid have an opportunity to explain it. Well, I forgot. And then there's nothing wrong with saying, well, I think you're making an excuse. If you didn't want to do it, just tell me you didn't want to do it, and we'll talk about that. But let's not make an excuse. So now this kid learns that, you know what, I can be open and honest, and it might not change the end result, but I know that somebody's going to ask me what was going on. And for all you know, this kid says, listen, I had a miserable day. I got in a fight with my best friend, and I failed the test. And there's all this stuff going on, and I just needed to go to my room for 10 minutes, and you asked me to wash the car as soon as I came home. Okay, that's good information to have. So the car still needs to be washed, let's say, but, you know, but maybe the kid can be offered a time frame. Oh, I understand. Okay, you know, maybe we can have this done by 5, you know, or whatever the situation is. And this leads into the next point in terms of communication, of being able to speak to a kid about what it is that's going on requires us to communicate with the kid, right? And requires the kid to have enough communication skills to communicate with us some of the pain that they might be experiencing. And again, we have to keep in mind, and it's tough sometimes as adults, but kids' pain, right, is just as significant as our pain, just on a littler scale. And we need to be able to tune into that, I think. Teaching skills to minimize the impact of daily stress, and we're going to go over one of those in a second. And again, just reiterating, long before a misbehavior happens, having some sort of understanding in the family and certainly with the kids about what are appropriate expectations, sort of setting that out beforehand. And I think it goes without saying, so I'll say it anyway, that parents need to be on the same page about this, or sometimes parents are not on the same page about it, and it might be fine, but the kid needs to know, mommy and daddy are not on the same page on this one, and here's why. And then the kid doesn't play one off or the other, because it's out there, right? These are known things. This is not a secret. The kid doesn't have to be manipulative, because there's nothing to be manipulative about, because I've been open and honest with you that we have a different approach about whatever it is that we have a different approach about.
One parent feels this way, one parent feels the other way. What if they get obstructed?
There's nothing not consistent about that. You're consistently being inconsistent between a mother and a father.
Feel that.
Again, it depends on the... No, because some things are appropriate for parents to disagree about. There might be some things, for instance, right, if one parent has a phobia, right, that they don't want their kids climbing to a height, right, in a jungle gym in a park, right? So the rule with dad, because he has this phobia, is that you cannot climb on these monkey bars. Right. The rule with mom is she's not nervous. She's perfectly okay with it. So go ahead and climb. Right? So being able to set that out and being able to tell a kid, you know what, when you're with mom, here's this rule, and when you're with dad, here's this rule, and please don't ask me because I'm really nervous about it.
What about like eating certain foods? Let's say one parent doesn't keep that healthy. Right. And so the father will bring home sugar cereals, and the mom will bring home healthy cereals, and of course the kids smell like the sugary cereals.
Correct.
So, like, you know,
so that's
does one parent just have to say, like, okay, you know, the kid's going to eat the sugary cereal because that's what they want to eat?
Mm-hmm. My guess.
And leave it like that. Shut up. Let's see a lot of the cereals. A lot of the cereals.
That's right. And I think that's
so
again, this is a wonderful opportunity for parents to be able to model healthy communication skills between parents. Mm-hmm. And if a mother says, I really don't want this, I don't want X, right? And a father says, I really do. Well, now this is a wonderful opportunity for a kid to learn, okay, so what do we do when one person wants and one person doesn't? How do we solve this? And in every situation, it might be different. And it doesn't mean that one person needs to give in and one person doesn't. But this is a wonderful learning opportunity for a kid to see this process. Because it's gonna play out in school, it's gonna play out in camp, it's gonna play out in all these realms that the kid operates from within.
Well,
I can't talk about every situation.
So
you know what I'm saying?
An example. And I'd like to know how to handle that.
It's a situation that I think requires the parents to really talk about what are my concerns about the sugar cereal, how often. Usually, arguments tend to start out that we're over here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you talk for like more than 7 seconds about what's going on, like the argument is like over here.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't mind if they have half a bowl, but I don't want them to have 3/4 of a bowl. Okay, so let's do like, you know, what's in the middle of a half and 3/4. Like, is that okay with everyone? Yes. Okay.
It should be seen as the compromising.
The compromising and the discussion about something that's important.
In a dignified, respectful way.
Correct. And that's more important. The kid is not going to remember, right, that I was able to have a half a bowl or 3/4 of a bowl of cereal. They couldn't care less. They really don't. What they care about is, what do I learn about life, about how to make decisions? Mm-hmm. And what am I seeing here? And if they know that every time, you know, the cereal cabinet opens, right, World War III is breaking out because everyone has their own shitas on what to do with sugar cereal, right? Life is chaos. But if they're able to see a good, healthy conversation about it. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with kids seeing parents disagree. As long as it's done in a good, respectful way. And sometimes the conversation ends up with, I have my idea, you have your idea, let's think about it. And that's perfectly fine. This is a wonderful lesson. You know what? We don't always need to agree with people in life. We could have one perspective of somebody, and both can be right and good and wonderful. But the kid can learn this lesson. And I think that's probably more important than whether they get 4 cavities with sugar cereal in it. Well, my father-in-law's a dentist, so I get to say that.
This also falls with Yiddish things.
Yes, very much so.
One parent, so parents watch movies,
yes,
videos, and the other parent has.
Yes. Yes, when I think with these conversations, I think it's extraordinarily important to be able to recognize when the parents have the conversation, that there are going to be certain things that can't be taken back, right? So if a kid is allowed to go to whatever movie, let's say, or watch whatever video, that can't be taken back. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, because they've been exposed to it, and it might be perfectly appropriate or whatever the situation is, right? So when the two, thank you. When the two people, right? When the two parents typically are trying to make this decision, part of the cheshvan of understanding, okay, so what do we do? Is, I have my idea, you have your idea. Potentially, let's say you change your mind. What can we add and what can we take away? Meaning that if they've already seen this, there's not much we can do, but we can always let them see it at a later time. So I think that's part of the negotiation process, let's call it, or the communication process that's going to take place, is people asking themselves the question, well, let's say I respect and admire the other person I'm having this conversation with, and I think they're a relatively normal, straightforward, down-to-earth person, and they generally have good ideas, right? But I have a separate idea about it. But is my idea and her idea, will they necessarily be in contradiction, right? That's point number one. And two is, if we go according to me, or according to you, whatever it is it something that if I ever change my mind about, or if I ever realize, hey, you're right about this, that this is something that we can retract. And generally, if people are at a stalemate, right, that's, to me, that's an important suggestion to make, is, you know, perhaps it makes sense to hold off on it because you might change your mind, and then, you know, you could always add it, but it's tough to take it away. And that's an important thing for kids to see. Thank you again. Good. So let's talk about one of the skills, and this is equally important for parents as it is for kids, but something really easy to teach a kid. It's called the time management matrix, and basically it's divided into things that are important and not important, and urgent and not urgent. And typically, right, the kids and even parents and adults that experience a lot of stress and a lot of frustration and a lot of anxiety is typically because they're operating for a bulk of their time in the not important, not urgent category. Right? Like, it's not urgent and certainly not important to plan out your 3-year-old's bar mitzvah. Right? If you had to spend time on something, that's probably not one of the things to spend time on. Right? So this is a good way, right? So instead of having these conflicts with kids, like, you know, like, do you need to sharpen your pencil 5,000 times? Like, you know, is this important? Is this urgent? So instead of having the battle, I want to sharpen my pencil. No, don't sharpen your pencil. Right? So instead of having that power struggle, which parents always lose, perhaps being able to set up this time matrix, well, you fill it in. You know, where would you put this in terms of urgent, not urgent, important, not important? Where would you put it? Let's talk about it. Let's discuss it. You know, maybe I would put it in one category. Maybe I would put it in another category. Typically, when kids are exposed to this matrix, they begin to realize, hey, okay, maybe I can put this over here. When's an appropriate time to introduce this matrix? Typically for 9 or 10 year old kids. Would be an appropriate time. And let them figure it out. Don't have the power struggle. Present them with this is the skill. Put it up on their wall or whatever it is, and they let them fill it in. And then you can... No, this up there, right, we talked about teaching and model essential communication skills, right, and appropriate behavior. This is a skill. This is something that a kid can learn in order to manage their own time, in order to be productive, in order to sort of be doing the right thing. Yeah, certainly. You know, where do we put this stuff? You know, is very helpful, and it's also helpful for a parent, right? If a kid has, you know, study for science and math and Gemara and this and the right, because they're all tomorrow, right? It's probably not a good idea to start asking them to clean for next Pesach, right, in June, right? So you're able to see sort of what's on their list, and then maybe you can judge the chores and their expectations, you know, sort of in a time limited way, in an appropriate way. It aids in communication. So good. So you know, these are sort of the lofty goals that we just presented, and you know, sort of at this point, people usually think, okay, so really, what do I do? Right? How do I manage this? Okay, enough. That's great. Like all the psychobabble, you know, like okay, what do I do? So number one is parents need to take care of themselves. If you are stressed, if you are frustrated, so will your kids be. Stressed and frustrated, and nothing's going to work out. And any punishment and any behavior modification program that you're going to put into place is not going to work because you're going to break it, not the kids, because there's just so much going on in life. So the first thing is parents really need to take care of themselves. And I think coming to these sort of things is a good way for parents to take care of themselves. Sharpen the saw, as it were. And again, just to reiterate, have that behavior plan, have those expectations in place way before anything happens. And certainly any rewards and punishments should be known about by you and the children but way before any situation might come up. I think it really depends on the parenting style of parents and kids. Some kids need it written down. Some kids are very visual. They need it written down. They need a picture. They need a something. Some kids couldn't care less. You know, some parents, like, I'm not going to remember from today till tomorrow what I said to my kids. I better write it down because I want to be consistent. Right. But, you know, so I leave that to, I leave it to individual.
The same thing, right?
Yeah, most definitely. So good. So if you're punishing, demanding, harsh, unremitting, yelling, screaming, hostile, aggressive, intimidating, right? Blah, 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 blah. What lesson is your child learning? Versus if you're warm, supportive, and encouraging, and all of those wonderful traits, right? What is your child learning? So in terms of misbehavior, I think the point is that they really are kids are going to mimic through their behavior the way that they perceive that they're treated by parents. And if they're treated in a warm, supportive, nurturing kind of way, typically the misbehavior is going to be, you know, like forgetting to throw out their dirty tissue, as opposed to, you know, forgetting to come home at night, because they really feel like home is an important place for them to be.
You keep saying the same thing over and over and over, like take a shower, take a shower, take a shower, and then finally the fifth time you just scream at them, you know, take a shower, right. You know what I mean, like you try to be nice, yes, and so then they just don't listen, so
that's a concept in psychology called more of the same, right? Typically when we want something to happen, when we terribly want something to happen, right, we'll just do the same thing over and over and over again and expect that this thing is just going to magically happen, right? So why is it that it's not? Right, take a shower, get undressed, take a shower. Take a shower. Well, it's not happening, right? They're hearing your words, but there's some reason that's not happening. So why do we believe that if we say it four or five or six times, that all of a sudden it's going to happen? Right?
It's not like you're talking English, but...
Right. So it's not a hearing problem, right? And it's not a processing problem, because they take a shower, right? It's not the problem, right? There's something that's holding this child back in order to do it. So I think after one or two times, right, it's appropriate to say to the kid, listen, you know I've asked you to take a shower, yes?
You're right.
Mm-hmm. You know that in order to take a shower, you need to take off your clothes and put them in the hamper. Mm-hmm. How come this is not happening? Okay, now you've left it open to the kid to explain to you what it is that's going on. So the explanation can be, I hate the smell of the shampoo. My friends in school told me that I smell every time I take a shower because the shampoo smells like disgusting coconut, right? Or you always make the water too hot. Or, you know, the, I don't know, whatever, right? The towels weren't washed well enough and the little pieces come off on me, right?
I don't know. Like, why are you
Well, you do know, right?
They just don't feel like doing it. It's not fun.
I don't believe that. That's like the surface level of what's going on with the kid. And there's got to...
They can't express it for whatever reason.
So then you need to help them. You need to help them. And this is where setting those appropriate boundaries and limits is a really good thing, right? Right now it's 6 o'clock. Your bedtime is at 7 o'clock, right? I want to be able to read your story, put you to bed in a good way. If you keep putting off the shower, I'm not going to be able to do that, and I really, really want to. Right now the choice is yours. And which kid in their right mind is it gonna, okay, great, okay, to jump into the shower? Because again, this goes back to the whole time, and you know, like if I push this off, you're gonna keep talking to me, right? Take a shower, right? As opposed to take a shower, hey, great job, thanks for taking a shower, right? The reward versus the punishment for the kid is it's imbalanced, right? So
you can tell them without asking.
Yes, because saying it for the... Because they know they got you. They won.
That's what they want?
Yes.
They want you to scream?
I used to watch the Discovery Channel, right? And I always used to be like amazed by like when they showed like the hunting scenes. Oh, that wasn't like a disgusting show. So they used to show like these hunting scenes, right? And I was always amazed that like this big animal would like go after this like nebuch little animal, right? They would look for the one that was lame, right? They'd go after this kid. They would like kill it in a vicious way. And then they would just like hang out. You know, like, all right, I killed this thing. Yeah, maybe I'll eat. Maybe I won't. You know, sort of just like walking around, calling everyone there. And I think kids see their relationship with parents in the same way. Like, if I got you to yell, I've killed my prey. I got it. I don't need to do anything else. I pushed your buttons, I got you to yell. I win. You lost. And they see this as a huge game. And it's so easy for us to lose. It's so easy for them to win.
But you don't want to be screamed at.
Like, oh no!
They get embarrassed.
They love it. No, they love it.
It's not embarrassing.
No.
At the same time, they want your approval too. They want to.
There's no question. There's no question about it. And they're gonna find, right, what typically after you scream, what do they try to do?
They run into the shower.
Right, because they do want that approval and they do want that love and they do want to be appreciated, right? But it's only after they won. So, and again, you're right. It does depend on the kid. But typically, saying it five or six times, right? Take a shower, take a shower, take a shower, take a shower, right? They're not getting anything more between time two and time five,
right?
So it's just a way for us to get more frustrated and give us our own excuse to yell at a kid. So let's try to do something different, right? If it's not working, right? If you're stuck in traffic, go a different route. Like, don't just sit there. So I think it's sort of like conceptually the same approach. So the question is, okay, so do I never punish a kid? Well, no. That's not what I said, right? It's punishment is certainly very important, but let's look at the balance, right? Why is it that if a kid does something good, they get a mumbled thank you, but when they're not going into the shower, they get yelled at and screamed at and all this attention, right? So let's look at that appropriate balance, and perhaps we need to look at how we're praising kids in an appropriate way, and what is it that we can do to sort of increase the chances that they're going to listen because they've gotten something good out of listening. Is there another way to get this very important message across the kids that positive is really great? I think certainly punishment for physically harming other people or property is certainly appropriate. But again, only after there's been a serious conversation about why it is that this happened, right? The worst thing that can happen is if, let's say, a kid is getting bullied at school and they beat up a younger sibling and right away they get punished, right? And there's no conversation about what it is that's going on. You've missed a really important opportunity to find out from this kid all the pain that they're experiencing and why they acted out this pain. So again, if they damage somebody else or somebody else's property, I think that's something that needs to be punished because they've crossed over that boundary, but it needs to be coupled with an important conversation of why is it that you think you did this, what was behind this, what was going on. Punishing chutzpah, right? You are so chutzpahdik now, you need to, right, fill in the blank, right? Guaranteed that kid will become more chutzpahdik at a later point when they know that, you know, they sort of pick up on when you're about to lose it. So right when you're on that line, they definitely, it's rest assured, they're going to become more chutzpahdik. So what do we do? Do we just leave it? So I think this goes back to what we were talking about before, is we got to find a different way to teach a message about chutzpah. Again, this goes back to, well, am I being chutzpahdik to a spouse? Am I being chutzpahdik to other people, in my life? How am I going to teach the message to a kid without punishing the chutzpah necessarily? Can I find a different way to teach a message to a kid that respect for parents is something that's really important and something that's really valued and something that's really beneficial for this kid?
Teach them?
One way is to just punish them and rest assured that it's going to come up again in a more aggressive form. The other way is to be able to say, listen, right now you're a chutzpahdik. That makes me upset. That makes me angry. That makes me feel like you don't respect me. Can we talk about what this means? And can we talk about why kibud av va'im is important? Again, in an age-appropriate way. And the time to do this isn't right when they're a chutzpahdik, right? Because you can't do it. They can. You can. And this is an important lesson. But again, the prevention is much more important than the way you're going to react to it at that particular time, right? So if you have a nice conversation, right? If you take a walk with a kid and have a nice conversation about the importance of kibud av va'im, that's something very important and why this is important, and they actually see you do it as opposed to just talking about it, right? Then you have a frame of reference when something does come up. Hey, remember that conversation we had? You know, this is an example of something going on. So in terms of I think it depends on the situation. When it comes to physical harm and
let's
harm
say,
to
the boy hits the girl.
Right. So I think it's appropriate to punish that because that's something that needs to stop right now. That's a boundary that child has crossed. That's an inappropriate boundary. But at the same time that you're punishing, whatever the punishment might be, and certainly one has to question whether physical aggression is the way to solve physical aggression. Right? It sort of seems like a very strange cycle in my mind. But it's up to each individual parent to figure that out on his or her own. But that cycle seems a little strange to me. But in terms of, so punishment is appropriate, but telling the kid at the same time, and we're going to talk about this, and we're going to talk about why you did this, and you're going to have to think about, part of the punishment is thinking about what has led you to this behavior, and what is this about? and then actually doing it and actually talking after you've calmed down a little bit about the situation. Common closing complaints about what we talked about tonight are listed over here, right? In Europe, it never was like this, right? That's like, right? You used to be able to hit a kid, or why are kids so sensitive nowadays? Well, I don't know, but they are. And you know, like, whatever, I'm not 80, so I can't, you know, like, times are changing, but you see more and more that the kids need to know and appreciate and really feel in a very, very tangible way our love and our appreciation and our respect and our admiration for all their wonderful strengths. And if they really hear that, the misbehavior is like this inverse correlation between the more love we provide equals the less misbehavior. And you know, is talking to a kid, is that going to spoil them? Is that going to not teach them that they can't do something? Well, I don't think so. I don't think you can never go wrong with communication. You can never be off by it. But just the personal opinion. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-1.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.